Join the conversation.
Email pippah@capetalk.co.za.
Now, on yesterday's show, we were chatting about the importance of making a will and making sure it's done well in advance and that it's lodged safely and your family know where to find it and executors appointed, etc. Today, we go a step further. A question came in yesterday that relates directly to a conversation we'd already planned. What about a living will? How is that different from the traditional will? And must that be done at the same time? We have an expert standing by to chat to us about the concept of a living will and what it is and what it should cover, how you go about drawing one up. And it's actually a conversation that predates yesterday's Will's conversation. It was prompted by a very sad email I received from one of our listeners called Dave a couple of weeks ago. His father had just passed away after a prolonged period of ill health and had spent weeks in hospital battling a severe infection. And the last fortnight of the time in hospital, he was in a coma with no brain function at all. And both his wife and his children wanted doctors to withdraw life support because they knew from former conversations that they had had with their dad that that would have been his wish. But because he had never drawn up a living will or signed any kind of do not resuscitate order, the doctors were not prepared to oblige. And the family ended up in an incredibly traumatic situation of not wanting to see their father's suffering prolonged, but not being able to get the hospital to act on that wish. They went to police to draw up a notarized document stating their wishes and absolving the hospital of responsibility. That was not accepted. They went to lawyers. They were actually on the verge of trying to press charges against the hospital when it became a moot point because their father did then pass away in the hospital. But this is what Dave went on to write to me. Since this happened to my father, I've spoken to a number of other people who've been through similar circumstances. The desperation and hopelessness that we felt, our lack of knowledge of our rights, it turned a difficult situation into a veritable hell. Please won't you do a segment on families' rights in these situations? And Dev, we are happy to do so with firstly our thanks to you for raising this important topic and of course our sincere condolences to your family on your loss and so sorry to hear of the trauma that compounded that loss. On the line with me is Professor Willem Landman, who is a specialist in medical ethics at Stellenbosch University's Department of Philosophy. Willem, lovely to have you with us on the show today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Pippa. Thanks for inviting me.
Let's start with the most basic of questions. What is a living will in layman's terms?
Pippa, it's actually a very simple concept and instrument. It is a living will is an expression of one's preferences or wishes, specifically relating to a condition in the that might happen to one in the future if we don't die suddenly of some medical condition or some kind of trauma, then we may continue to live in some kind of shadowy condition where we've lost our ability to make decisions. And we want to exclude futile medical treatment during, in such an eventuality. So a living will is very simple in the sense that stop treatment, discontinue life-sustaining treatment, life support of any kind, medication procedure, life support machines, because treatment would be futile and it is not my wish. I do want to die in a dignified way. So the essence is stop life support in certain conditions. And we can talk about what those conditions would be, but certainly it relates to being permanently and irreversibly unable to express one's wishes at that time, but we are in a position while we are still competent to express our wishes or desires for such an eventuality.
Professor, the right to life is protected by the Constitution. Are there competing constitutional rights that come into play here that would be balanced against that right in terms of a person's personal wishes?
Absolutely. And the first remark I want to make is that we may have a right to life, but we do not have an obligation to live whatever the circumstances of our life are. So it's not an obligation to live. The right to life needs to be explored in specific context. But there's a specific right to human dignity, and we can argue that there are undignified ways of dying. And secondly, there's the right to bodily, what the Constitution's Bill of Rights calls a right to bodily and psychological integrity, which includes the right to security and control of one's body. So I would say those are the main constitutional rights that give us a reason to respect a living will, a reason relating to our law to respect a living will.
Well, that was going to be my next question. How does the law view such a document? Does it have legal weight if it's been properly drawn up, signed and witnessed?
The problem is that we don't have a law or part of the National Health Bill of 2003 that explicitly refers to a living will, using the term living will. So there is no explicit law on living wills, unlike many other jurisdictions, like, for example, every one of the 50 states of the United States has a law explicitly setting out the conditions for drafting and executing, a living will. But apart from the constitutional argument, I can say that if a doctor does not comply with the living will and thinks that he or she could be sued because of negligence and therefore ignores a living will, the counter argument, if we want to talk about the law, is that one could be sued for unwanted treatment of a person, going against a person's expressed informed consent. So, apart from the constitutional argument, I think there's an argument based on the National Health Act, which says that every medical decision, that every treatment that we receive, whether it be a procedure such as surgery or any other procedure or medication, we have to give informed consent. Now, we often don't give it explicitly, but we give it in an implied way or by means of our conduct. Now, if we refuse to give informed consent, then a doctor or medical professional would treat us against our will, would be guilty of assault. So the idea is that with a living will is that we extend the notion of informed consent beyond what the contemporaneous decisions that we make. We say, in a future eventuality that might happen to us, we want to have a treatment discontinued. So my point would be that even the National Health Act, which stresses the importance of informed consent, that can be extended to the fact, by means of the fact that we've refused to give informed consent under certain conditions should we find ourselves in a certain condition in future. So I think the second, apart from the Constitution, our second legal argument would be that we can extend the principles of the National Health Act and argue for the recognition of a living will. So to answer your question very briefly, there isn't an explicit act. It has been suggested by the South African Law Commission. The Parliament hasn't taken that up in 2019, 20 years later, after the South African Law Commission report. There was an effort. It went through the drafting stages in Parliament, and then COVID-19 happens and the election. So it was put on ice. A specific extension of the National Health Act to legalize and set out the conditions for a living will.
Okay. In the absence of that existing in law right now, as a matter of interest, as far as you're aware, has anybody in South Africa successfully prosecuted a doctor for assault for having continued treatment against a person's expressed wishes?
No. As far as I know, not. If I could just refer to your introductory case study or scenario of Dave. The problem, yes, there was no living will, and the doctors kept on treating his father, providing life-sustaining treatment, life support in various ways. Now, when his father lost his competence, in other words, his ability to make rational decisions for himself, by law, again, the National Health Act, Section 7, appoints a surrogate decision maker. A surrogate decision maker automatically comes into existence, and that surrogate is entitled in law to make a decision on behalf of the principal, in this case, Dave's father. Mm-hmm. And if the surrogate's decision is not respected, it is no different from respecting the decision of the principal. In other words, informed consent is not given by the surrogate. That is a very, very serious matter, and I think it's a huge misunderstanding on the part of the treating doctors with Peter Dave's father. They were certainly liable to be prosecuted for giving treatment where it was specifically declined. In other words, they ignored the proxy decision maker appointed in terms of the National Health Act, or somebody automatically becomes a surrogate decision maker. Of course, the law also allows one to explicitly appoint a surrogate decision maker for oneself. You can designate your spouse or your child or whatever the case may be. If you don't, it's not a problem. The law makes provision for the person who is actually then making your healthcare decisions on your behalf. Okay. So they ignored Dave and his family, which is a very serious matter, which led to all kinds of consequences. But it's not surprising, Pippa. On a weekly basis, I get these cases.
That's really disappointing to hear. Listening to this conversation is Linda, who's a medical doctor, who's written in saying, I often assist people with serious illnesses, and I believe every adult, irrespective of their age or health status, should have an advanced healthcare plan or living will. Now, Willem, are there templates available to draft one? How does one go about doing it? Do you need legal assistance, or can you find a version on the internet to download and fill out for yourself?
You can find it on the internet. You would find a template, say, for example, on the website of Dignity South Africa. Mm-hmm. But you can find them. I think most lawyers would have them. They're out on the internet. It's a very, very simple document. You can then simply tailor it to your own exigencies. You can have two witnesses attesting, and you sign it. And you lodge it in specific places. It should be available when this does kick in. The eventuality that it does kick in. But you can, most lawyers would have templates, and they would help you. They would see that it's that it complies with all the requirements of the legal document. Mm-hmm. But it's a very simple document. It's a very simple document. It says that I'm 18 years old, of sound mind. I'm acting in my own free will. I'm not acting under duress. I've carefully considered all the implications of this will, and I then say that if I, at any future date, should develop terminal or incurable medical condition, or I'm in a vegetative state, or completely and irreversibly unconscious, I can no longer make competent decisions for myself. I want any form of treatment that would extend my life terminated, refused, withdrawn, or withheld. Providing, obviously, still continuing to provide comfort care should that be needed if one can experience pain. So it's very simple, and you can list the kinds of treatment that you would not want. You can say, I do not want artificial nutrition. I do not want artificial hydration. I don't want dialysis, medication, including antibiotics. And that's very important. Often people are dying and they get some kind of a secondary infection, and then life is extended by administering antibiotics to them. So you can say, I do not want antibiotics in these circumstances when I have this terminal and incurable medical condition, or I'm at a vegetative state, or permanently and completely and irreversibly unconscious. So the point is, I want to die a natural death. The whole idea is that science has become so advanced that it keeps us alive beyond the natural, what would have been a natural point of death. And treatment does extend our bodily life, but not our conscious or personal life. So it is futile in the sense that it cannot achieve any worthwhile end other than simply keeping the body alive, and our circulation and aspiration continuing. Mm-hmm.
Very difficult and interesting ethical question just posed on our WhatsApp line. We're almost out of time, but I think it is important to ask, and I hope it's being asked as an exercise in ethics alone. Can a living will be used to prevent resuscitation in a suicide case?
Well, I mean, that
tough one. It's a really tough one.
There.
Yeah.
You know, the point about the, you know, suicide is not illegal, and if you, our natural instinct is to resuscitate somebody. If we do not have any further information, if we do have information that this was a serious attempt at suicide. It depends, Pippa. Are we talking about somebody who has a terminal illness and really any treatment would be futile, or if we talking about somebody who's temporarily depressed? You know, somebody who's walking away from, you know, the normal kinds of responsibilities that we have as human beings. I would say some kinds of suicide are really understandable, and because there's a lot of suffering involved. Other kinds of suicide, we may say, are just simply a cop-out and the result of a temporary sort of error in judgment. And then there's a whole range of suicides in between, a whole gray area. But a living will, I've never seen a living will that states that if I have a failed suicide, that they don't resuscitate me. Because it would just be too thorny an issue. We need more information, because there's so many different kinds of suicide and there's so many different kinds of reasons for suicide.
Okay. Tough one to put you right at the end of the interview, Professor. Thank you very much for giving it a go, and really appreciate the very helpful information you've shared with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, bye-bye. Thanks.
Professor Willem Landman, a specialist in medical ethics at Stellenbosch University's Department of Philosophy.